Good afternoon and welcome to our webinar to discuss New York's recently enacted Consumer Credit Fairness Act. I'm your host, Jocelyn Ager, the managing partner of Frank Frank, Goldstein & Ager, a law firm devoted to bad debt. Today's presentation will run approximately 15 minutes in length. There will be 5 minutes for questions and answers at the end. The program will be recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, please end the program now. What can you expect from today's program? You can expect to gain a working understanding of the Consumer Credit Fairness Act, its effect upon you or your client's debt collection efforts, and on your bottom line. The Consumer Credit Fairness Act is reflective of New York's legislative shift towards consumers. The act was signed by Governor Kathy Hochul on November 8, 2021, and became effective in part in April and May 2022. The act is perhaps the most significant change to New York state law as it relates to collection and protection of consumers within New York state. The act and what will follow next is a direct about-face from New York's liberal debt collection rules and laws intended to be a wake-up call to creditors and debt buyers alike. It should be noted that the act applies exclusively to debt collection efforts directed towards a consumer, meaning when the one who owes the money is a purchaser, borrower, or debtor, and a consumer. Although the act affects only consumer credit transactions, the definition of consumer credit transactions is, at the time of today's presentation and recording of this program, currently being litigated. In the past, legislation governing debt collection has affected debt collectors, not direct creditors. The Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, a federal statute governing consumer debt collection, as well as many of the rules imposed by New York's Department of Financial Services, affects debt collectors only and not the actual creditors. Not so with the Consumer Credit Fairness Act. The act affects creditors and third-party debt collectors alike. Let's talk about the key provisions of the act. The change to the statute of limitations. To recover for services rendered, the statute of limitations had been 6 years, meaning that a creditor had 6 years to collect monies owed. For goods sold and delivered, the time to collect from consumers was arguably 4 years, governed by the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC. As a result of the Consumer Credit Fairness Act, the time to collect monies owed from consumers has decreased to 3 years. A creditor now has half the time to collect money owed to them by consumers. The statute of limitations, tolling the statute of limitations. There are situations that will extend or toll the statute of limitations past 3 years. Most common are on-account payments made by consumer customers or clients. The statute will be extended for an additional 3 years from the time the on-account payment was made. Here's how it works. Let's say you were an architect or interior designer rendering services to an individual designing their new home. The client made no payments for 2 years and 11 months. However, on the eve before the statute was going to lapse for 3 years, the consumer made an on-account payment. The consumer has therefore tolled or extended the statute. The service professional will have an additional 3 years to collect the balance owed, running from the date the on-account payment was made. However, let's say the 3 years has passed, the statute lapsed, but the consumer made a payment nonetheless. The on-account payment will not restart the statute. Revival of the consumer debt is prohibited by the Consumer Credit Fairness Act. Once the statute lapses, you lose your right to attempt to collect the debt. Another major change is to the legal rate of interest. The legal rate of interest varies by state. Each state sets their own legal rate of interest. What this means is that when a lawsuit is commenced, absent an underlying agreement. If requested, the court will award the creditor the principal amount owed, together with interest to be calculated at the state's legal rate of interest. Before the act, New York's legal rate of interest for consumer and commercial accounts alike had been 9%, but not anymore. Thanks to the act, there is a distinction between the legal rate of interest for consumer and for commercial cases. The legal rate of interest for commercial claims remains at 9%, but the legal rate of interest for consumer claims has been decreased to 2%. The new 2% legal rate of interest is the rate of interest to be used prospectively, but is also to be calculated retroactively for judgments which remain partially or wholly unpaid or unsatisfied. Same is true for lawsuits that were commenced before the effective date of the act and have not yet been reduced to judgment. You should be aware that the retroactivity of the act as of today's program is currently being litigated as well. Other changes include documentation required to be part of the litigation process. For example, a complaint must also accompany a summons in consumer credit transactions. Prior to the act, a lawsuit could have been commenced with the mere filing of a summons without a complaint detailing the debt. But in order to provide more robust information about the underlying debt, the summons must be filed together with the complaint, providing the details relating to the debt owed by the consumer. Also, the contract or agreement upon which the action is based must also be attached to the summons and complaint when filed. The Consumer Credit Fairness Act has many more requirements as it relates to debt buyers or assignees. That is because when a debt is bought or sold, there is sometimes less documentation available to evidence the debt. Consumers have been sued for debts not owed or previously time barred, and from the bare bones pleadings, which had been acceptable prior to the enactment of the act, consumers were barely able to discern what the debt was, how it was incurred, or to whom it was owed. The act imposes that the creditor set forth a chain of custody seeking to recover on the debt, which must include the original name of the creditor when the default in payment occurred, as well as affidavits supporting the claim. The affidavits needed are available on the court's website. There should be an itemization of the amount demanded, broken down by principal, interest, finance charges, other charges, collection costs, and if appropriate, attorney's fees. Revolving credit accounts will require even further information: the amount of the debt due as of the charge-off, the amount of interest accrued since charge-off, the total amount of non-interest charges or fees accruing since charge-off, and the total amount of payments and or credits made on the debt since charge-off. If one of the causes of action is for an account stated, meaning that one of the theories to win the case is that the creditor is entitled to judgment, not because of the work performed or goods sold, but because statements were mailed to the debtor, the date when the final statement was sent to the consumer must reference the summons and complaint. Statements should include the last four digits of the account number. The Act also includes additional requirements for litigation involving consumer credit transactions. When the debtor has not appeared in the action, is in default, and the creditor is seeking a judgment on default based upon non-appearance by the consumer debtor, there is an additional notice requirement. The notice, which is to be prepared in English and Spanish by the creditor or their counsel, must accompany the proposed judgment together with a stamped envelope addressed to the consumer debtor. Rather than trusting the debt collector or the creditor to mail the statement, the court will mail the additional notice to the consumer debtor on their own. Similarly, when making a motion for summary judgment, which is basically setting forth the facts of a case and asking the court to apply the relevant law, an additional notice must be sent to the debtor. The notice explains what summary judgment means and details how the consumer can and should oppose the motion by way of affidavit and documentation to their opposition papers and how they should file the papers. I think it's important to illustrate the effect of some of the provisions as they relate to consumer collections to give you a better understanding. Let's say an accounting firm services related corporate entities as well as the firm's principals. Perhaps the firm was concerned about the threat of malpractice and decided to wait 3 years before pursuing the consumer for payment. By waiting the 3 years, the creditor can no longer demand payment for the services rendered to the individual principals. They can, however, pursue the corporate debtors for up to 6 years. Let's say the corporate debtors, however, owe money and agree to pay. The principal will agree to personally guarantee payment of the corporate debt. The creditor has 6 years to pursue the corporate debtors, and in this case, 6 years to pursue the individual guarantors. The three-year statute imposed by the Act would not apply because the guarantee, although executed by an individual, was done so in a commercial context and not as a result of an underlying consumer claim. Let's take the same accounting firm who handled personal tax work for the principal, now seeking to enforce its right to get paid from the principal within the three-year statute. The firm, if they were to commence litigation, would need to attach the underlying engagement letter to the summons and complaint. If they fail to do so, their action to recover the balance from the individual debtor would fail since they failed to comply with the new requirement of attaching the underlying agreement to the summons and complaint. I know what you might be thinking. What happens if an engagement letter does not exist? Assuming that is the situation, the accounting firm can still seek to recover the balance owed from the consumer as well as to a corporate debtor if that was the case. But the summons and complaint would need to be worded differently by counsel so that the accounting firm could recover the reasonable value of their services. Let's leave the accounting firm alone and move on to a residential contractor. It's important to distinguish the contractor's claim against the consumer's property rather than that as against the homeowner. The lien rights of a contractor or a subcontractor attach to the underlying property, not to the consumer themselves, and are therefore not affected by the Consumer Credit Fairness Act. However, a civil action against the consumer to collect for the work performed would be governed by the Act. The contractor will still have 3 years to recover from the consumer homeowner. Some suggestions. I would suggest begin with the three-year period in mind. Have reasonable expectations with regards to in-house collection efforts and the time to spend on those efforts. Companies doing business with consumers will need to revamp their credit and collection policies. If not done already, update and make sure underlying agreements are prepared and circulated, and try to get sign-offs from the consumers before going ahead with work or delivering goods. Have a system of maintaining the underlying agreements so that you'll be able to access them and use them when needed. Make sure to issue statements of accounts to consumers, date them, and include the last four digits of the account number on the statement. Segregate the balance owed as required by the Act in advance so you're ready to go. Have a relationship with a debt collection firm experienced and aware of the significance of the Act and the parameters in which to operate. And have a plan to get the debts out the door sooner so that you can pursue the balances owed with the assistance of a debt collection firm. Thank you for attending the webinar. Have a great day.